is the Grailian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's Beyond the Fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grailian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
From hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Grailian Bunker, welcome one and all. It is the Grailian Report. I'm your host, as always, in pocket, Micah Hanks. Glad to be here with you. Fresh back from traveling, as I am apt to do and often. And so I'm glad, and it's good to be back underground, below the radar, and keeping an eye to the skies on what is happening abroad and elsewhere. Of course, as always, joining me in studio is the one and only man with the plan, Mr. Matthew Oakley. Good evening to you, sir.
Good evening to you as well.
Yeah, good to see you, pal. It's been a few days, and so I guess we've got a lot to get caught up on. And, of course, we'll be bringing a few of you out there and the listening audience along. As always, you can follow us, trend with us, as we take not only to the airwaves but to social media, at Micah Hanks on Twitter, at Grailian Reverend on Twitter, and of course at Grailian Report. But you can also join us at kgraradio.com/chat. Tonight, looking ahead, we are going to be talking a little bit about some of the big developments with SpaceX. We've also got some information, and we'll be getting to this in pretty short order, a new expedition being launched to head down to Antarctica. Yeah, this is going to be really interesting. The Antarctic Peninsula. More on that in a moment. And then later, wild men in history and the folkloric origins of this phenomenon. Definitely something that's long interested us. So there's so much to get into, so little time. Matt, what did I miss while I was gone? I hear that our beloved French Broad River has been under siege, that there was a huge, like a fuel leak into the river that occurred while I was gone?
Yeah, it appears kerosene was a lot of kerosene was leaked into our river that everybody loves to go down to. So there have been healing ceremonies and a lot of people coming out and showing solidarity with the river, I guess.
Solidarity with the river, huh? Okay. Well, you know, I mean, the real issue is that we do definitely have some issues, of course, when there are environmental concerns at play. And that's what I just found out about last night. Of course, we'd been at an archaeology show over the weekend, and I'm surrounded by lithics. I'm surrounded by all these beautiful things that the Seven Ages team and I are down there looking at in Greenville, North Carolina. I mean, it was a really nice event. I got to tell you, a really, really nice event. And some of the items on display, I'll just put it to you like this. I mean, we'll have a lot more to say about that on the Seven Ages Audio Journal podcast. But I get home, and naturally, I'm just thinking, man, I am so ready for spring weather, for getting out into the rivers, for looking for things out there in the rivers, you know, whether it be artifacts or whether it be, you know, hellbenders. And I'm looking for locations around Western North Carolina that might be interesting to visit, which are cultural heritage sites, you know, of the Cherokee. And actually, to tell you the truth, what I found was that there are a lot of them that date back probably to times much earlier than the Cherokee and their arrival here in the Southeast. One of them was an ancient mound site. It's almost completely leveled at this point, but at one time it was believed that it probably stood close to 30 feet high, and it existed on the property of what's now the Biltmore Estate. Matt, did you know that there was a large Indian mound that would have been, well, it, at one time was large, right down there on the Biltmore Estate?
I did not. What portion of the property?
It's one of the lower fields right down there alongside the river, of course.
Okay.
Yeah, I was fascinated to hear about this. They'd actually carried out excavations, and this, what it was, you know, again, it had been kind of heralded at the time as being a Cherokee heritage cultural site, but what they found during the excavations was that without question, it dated back to an older time, and that what we were actually looking at was probably something from hundreds of years earlier and representative of the same kinds of lodges built for ceremonial purposes that we find much further north, all the way up to Ohio. So who knows? I mean, this may have been a group of travelers. This could have been almost anything, but it was interesting, however you want to look at it. And when I'm looking at all this, I'm seeing people make references to, hey, here's why you need to stay out of the French Broad River right now, between Amboy Road and all the way, they're saying all the way down to Marshall. And I'm like, okay, something has happened. This is a recent report. And so I go over to the Citizen Times, and they're talking about, sure enough, as Matt said, there was a chemical spill, well, fuel, that leaked into the French Broad River. And people's response, rather than going out there and trying to get involved in terms of environmental protections and whatnot, activism, however one would like to try and respond to something like this, people are saying that they want to drop roses. And Matt, tell me, what were they all saying? They were
So there was a post that several friends of mine shared that it appeared that there was going to be a healing ceremony that took place for the river in the benefit of the river, where they apparently offered prayers and said, bring down healing crystals and flowers to put in the river. And in parentheses, they, of course, had to mention that roses have the highest vibration, good positive vibration, so those should be brought in quite abundance. I thought it was a little... I mean, I'm going to be honest, fatuous, you know. I'll be sure to bring in some healing crystals next week.
Well, anyway, I was really sad to hear that there were issues going on down there at the French Broad. And again, I hope that they get that all cleared out, because even if you're not someone who likes going around and looking at cultural heritage sites near the French Broad like I do, I know that a lot of people do like getting out there and water tubing and things, but hey, you know, that's okay. Not everybody's going to be affected by that. Heading a little further south than the southeast... That's right, BBC.com was reporting on this British team of scientists who are wanting to try and study an Arctic realm that has been hidden for thousands of years. Some, of course, you know, rather sensationally calling this a mysterious locality. Here's what we know. A British Antarctic survey team will explore the seabed ecosystem exposed when a giant iceberg broke away from the Antarctic Peninsula in 2017. This was widely reported. People were, I mean, you'd have thought that the world was ending. But the organization has also released the first video of the berg, as it's being called, which covers almost 6,000 square kilometers. I mean, it is quite large, and its true scale begins to emerge in a shot that was filmed from an aircraft flown along its edge. So they say that an international team is going to be spending 3 weeks between February and March on board the research ship RRS James Clark Ross, navigating ice-infested waters to reach the remote Larsen Sea ice shelf from which the berg had caved. British Antarctic Survey marine biologist Dr. Katrin Lentz, who is leading the mission, said that the caving of the iceberg, which has been named A68, provides researchers with a unique opportunity to study marine life as it responds to a dramatic environmental change. Sky News reported on a little differently, and I want to compare and contrast here. They said that scientists are traveling to Antarctica, again, to investigate a mysterious marine ecosystem hidden under an iceberg four times the size of London. The way it's reported, you would think that they were looking for the lost civilization of Lemuria down there. The team, they say, led by the British Antarctic Survey, leave the Falklands on the 21st of February to collect samples from the newly exposed seabed beneath the iceberg. Now, it will be interesting to see what they find down there. And I can't help but think about some of the ideas that have been espoused over the years in terms of what may lay beneath the ice. In fact, we were talking about this while the guys and I were on the road over the weekend, and how at the end of Fingerprints of the Gods by Graham Hancock, there are all these interesting ideas that are laid out as far as, you know, what may be evidence of a lost civilization, what may be the best evidence of the existence of said civilization. And if said civilization does exist, where would they have existed in antiquity, and why can't we find them today? And I'll be honest, Matt, you know, where I thought I saw things going had been that Hancock was going to lay out the case that Egypt itself or something like that had been the source of the lost civilization. In other words, Hancock and others make the argument, which I think is debatable, but nonetheless, they make the argument that the pyramids are actually older than they appear to be, that perhaps the Sphinx is the best evidence of, and there's good geological evidence that does suggest that perhaps it's older than it appears to be, or that it had been estimated to be by Egyptologists. And then with the discovery of sites like Göbekli Tepe, people are like, oh my gosh, look, they were building things. And now we know we've actually got direct evidence, datable evidence that shows that this goes all the way back 10,500 years or so. So many have said, look, you know, there is good evidence that supports people were building things much longer ago. And so in reading Fingerprints of the Gods, one almost gets to the point where they expect that the emphasis is going to be laid on Egypt. But at the conclusion, I don't want to give too much away, but then again, the book's, when was it published? I mean, gosh.
Yeah, it's been out a while.
It's been quite a while. So the end conclusion that I'd been expecting from Hancock had been Egypt. No, he says Antarctica. He says, where could a lost civilization have been hidden for so long? Why would we not be able to detect it if it were under the ice of Antarctica? That seems pretty unlikely based on what we know in terms of geological phenomena these days. But nonetheless, I'm sure that many people are going to be expecting, yep, they're going to find ruins, they're going to find all kinds of things down there. What they indeed may find, though, is evidence of, again, the ways that things have changed over time, the role that Antarctica played in the ancient world in terms of, again, you know, continental drift and whatnot, and what it might have actually been like and what might have existed there prior to.
Well, I just think you have to connect the dots there, Micah. You have to think that they will find something, and that's going to, you know, validate a lot of people's theories and opinions on the Piri Reis map, right?
Well, I am interested in maps like that, as you know.
Yeah.
I'm in fact, I would dare say I'm fascinated in the Piri Reis map because, again, the best explanation I can come to for that is that people definitely knew that there were, and nobody really disputes that it was known that there was a landmass down there. Where this kind of gets a little hinky is the fact that people were probably projecting on those ancient maps what they expected to be down there. And they were drawing this. And so some of these maps probably do show the expectation of this southerly continent. When I look at the Piri Reis map, I, like most, see what is more likely the distorted coastline of South America. But then again, Charles Hapgood, when he in the 1960s was doing his research, I think that basically his case was that once we determined the center point of the map, and there were circles that were aligned, which obviously appeared throughout the different parts on the map, which were on what would have been the diameter of a larger circle. So we had to find the center of that circle. And then we were able to figure out basically what the center point of the world for the... keep in mind, the Piri Reis map is just a fragment. There was once a much larger portion that showed further to the east.
Yeah.
We don't have access to all of that. And so what he was trying to do was he was essentially working to try and reconcile what the rest of the map would have been like, and therefore what the southerly portions showed based on the projections upon which the map were drawn. He felt it was strongly implied that, again, the ancient people who drew it, well, we know Piri Reis drew that map. The earlier maps drawn by ancient people upon which it was allegedly based employed mathematics, and Hapgood believed that some of this math far exceeded the levels known in antiquity. And further, he even, at one point, he just kind of touches on this and just moves on, but he makes the case that Hipparchus, when he discussed discovery of trigonometry, he wondered if indeed actually he had come upon an existing tradition of use of this, even in a rudimentary form, this mathematic knowledge. And rather than inventing it, in other words, I might say, for instance, Matt, I discovered a stone in a field, but that doesn't mean I invented that stone. And it may be something that was lost in translation. He, rather than actually creating a mathematical system, perhaps he came upon evidence of something and adapted it, but it had been in use in ancient times. And according to Hapgood, if the ancient map makers who were designing maps upon which the Piri Reis map was later based, it could be that the projections indeed indicated Antarctica and knowledge of that coastline. But, you know, again, that was Hapgood's estimation. I think the more likely explanation is, again, just a distorted South American coast. There are other maps, and that's what's really interesting, other maps that more clearly show what is obviously Antarctica. Some of those maps actually do appear to show the, even if they're rough, they may not be perfect, but they are the general shape of landforms as they are expected to appear beneath the ice that covers Antarctica. So when you think about all these things on those terms, you kind of go, gosh, did somebody actually go down there? Were there ancient sailors who went and they actually may have at very least mapped the coastline? Could this have all been based on expectations for what Antarctica looked like? That is also possible. And in many cases, I think it's more likely. But were there people there at some point in the ancient past who mapped that coastline before Antarctica was under the ice? That's the most unlikely of them all, and the one that I find the hardest to buy. But well, like we've talked about many times, Matt, Antarctica continues to fascinate. People are always fascinated by it. And I think in a lot of instances, they're kind of drawn to that area because of the mystery that it seems to hold.
I think part of it goes to that unknown aspect. You know, we do have the conspiracy theories about the Nazis getting down there at some point or another, and then these strange maps. It's kind of mired in mystery.
Yeah. Well, moving on to other things, scientists are now saying that everything on Earth could get quite cool in the years to come, much cooler than they are now. And this based on what one study says are 20 years of observations and collected data calculating that the sun will be nearly 7% cooler and dimmer by 2050, which could result in a mini ice age. Now, this reported by MoneyControl.com, a research team based at the University of California in San Diego believes they have figured out a way to track the sun's 11-year cycle, which moves again where it experiences active and quiet periods. These are known as the solar maximums and solar minimums. And that 11-year cycle has often fascinated me, where you'll see almost no sunspots, and then you'll see a huge surge in them. And it has often been noted at different times that temperature variances here on Earth can coincide with these cycles. The researchers with this current study believe that they've worked it out when this next solar minimum could occur. And with the equivalent decrease in magnetism and the fewer sunspots forming, they're saying that conditions in the next cold period, labeled a grand minimum, could be similar to those experienced in Europe in the middle of the 17th century. I believe that was what was called the Maunder Minimum. It was a little ice age that occurred. Back then, they said that the River Thames froze as a result of those extremely low temperatures, and people could go out there ice skating. Similarly, I think that there are references also during the Revolutionary War of Washington and the guys crossing the Delaware and it being icy, but it was, I mean, in what should have been spring. That was due to the colder climate temperatures on Earth during that period. And so imagine that Revolutionary War being fought in this winter where it was colder than normal, really, if we think historically. Now, according to media reports, they say the research team believes there is a, quote, significant probability of a near-future grand minimum, considering the downward sunspot pattern in recent solar cycles, which is similar to the period prior to previous grand minimum events. By their estimates, the grand minimum would most likely cool the Earth by about 0.25% between 2020 and 2070. As a result, the surface of the Earth would cool by up to several tenths of a degree Celsius, which is not enough to reverse the impact of global warming, but could dilute its effects for a while. So this is going to raise some very interesting questions, because we very well may be seeing at some point in the imminent future a little ice age. Could be decades from now, but if it happens, it very well may offset some of the effects of anthropogenic climate change. But again, we're probably not going to be seeing global warming during that period. What would be also of interest would be, will the effects of anthropogenic climate change contribute to greater cold temperatures? Because some people say, rather than global warming, since we use that term climate change, coinciding with many of the years where we see the hottest temperatures, we also see rain and snow during the winters, colder, wetter winters, you know, more precipitation across the board. So if that indeed ends up happening, it makes you wonder, I mean, how severe will the conditions be? I don't think that they're going to be like, you know, ice age type stuff, but it'll get pretty cool if it's anything like the Maunder Minimum. And that happened. That's on record. We know that these kinds of cyclical patterns do occur in nature. It may get cooler soon, more likely than it is to be hot, as many have expected.
And I have to wonder a little bit here. As I was reading this article, when I found it, I was wondering if people were going to be able to maybe use this as a argument against climate change, you know, politicize something that's going to be happening.
Well, people will always do that.
Yeah, absolutely. But to act like science doesn't have a leg to stand on because, hey, it's getting colder, you know?
That's the problem, that many people tend to see something that goes contrary to what is widely held, or, you know, vice versa. It could just be that whenever you find something that seems to contribute to your preconceptions or your biases, your beliefs, people always latch on to those arguments. That's a fairly common trend in all of this. Yeah. You remember the old expression, physician, heal thyself? I remember looking into the origins of that expression, but I was thinking about that recently. It came to mind when I was studying this report that's talking about scientists creating an electronic sort of skin that they believe will be useful in the future in terms of creating touch sensations. It will be able to essentially detect temperature. And yes, this skin, kind of like our own, will be able to heal itself. For those who have been looking long for evidence of everything from regeneration to, you know, self-healing, and being able to advance the rate of healing and things like this, and also regrowing lost limbs and things. We've always known that if you lose, for instance, a finger, that's not going to grow back. But human skin definitely has the ability to do what many other things in nature, like a lizard losing its tail, like insects that lose a leg and it'll grow back. Our skin, that's the one part of the human biology that does tend to grow back. If we could replicate that in a laboratory, imagine what could be done. And Forbes reports on this. They say, again, this is an e-skin, Okay. And that's actually what they're calling it. E-skin stands for electronic skin, a synthetic replica of skin that mimics many properties of real skin, like, well, being soft, but also being malleable and able to sense touch, airflow, humidity, and temperature and regenerate itself. Now, the Department of Chemistry and Biochemistry at the University of Colorado in Boulder, Colorado, created a thin layer of translucent material that is equipped with sensors that they say will be able to do all this and contains a polymer, polyimine, I believe is what it's called, that's laced with silver nanoparticles that enhance its strength and also the general electrical conductivity of this. But here's the other cool thing about this. In addition to being able to regenerate, there's another re that we can attribute to this. This skin is also recyclable. They say if you dip it into a recycling solution that includes ethanol, and the polymers will dissolve into a smaller series of components, and then the silver nanoparticles sink to the bottom, and all of the components can then be reused to create new e-skin. Okay, so if you are wearing this skin, you don't want to get near certain ethanol, certain liquid combinations. One might lose some skin, but don't lose sleep over it, because apparently the skin could be used again to grow back. How strange is that? There's a new show on Netflix, Matt, called Altered Carbon. Are you aware of this?
I have heard about it. I haven't caught it myself yet.
Altered Carbon. Yeah, it's interesting. I sat down and began to kind of watch one of the episodes, but all of these sci-fi shows these days, they just tend to mimic one another. I don't have a whole lot of time to watch television. Another one I sat down and really tried to get into and failed miserably at getting into was...
The New Cloverfield?
Did we talk about this?
No, we haven't.
Yeah, well, you guessed it. Yeah, The Cloverfield Paradox. Oh, God.
I heard it's just top-notch.
No, it's really not. It's awful. The Cloverfield Paradox, I'm not going to go into it. I'm just going to tell people, don't waste your time. Just go back and watch the original Alien and all the other films it was trying to basically be.
I just love the Cloverfield franchise. Now, the second one, the 10 Cloverfield Lane, I didn't mind. I thought
that was pretty good, though the ending was a little... credulous, but yeah. You know, my suspension of disbelief kind of goes out the window there, but
I just love how this franchise keeps creeping back into our lives ever since your brother Caleb really just entrenched all of us in the marketing campaign of the original.
Yeah, you know, the thing about Cloverfield, I remember that's what sold that film. The marketing campaign was brilliant. Oh, yeah. The marketing for the film was really, really good. Then they actually put the film out, and we are all waiting to see all the loose threads come together, and none of it ends up making any sense. With all the viral marketing, with all the insinuations into what is Slusher, what is this website, there are photographs of something mysterious that have been revealed online, there was an Easter egg that appeared in another J.J. Abrams film, which seems to suggest something that might be related to Slusher, which is a weird little website that was put up online that probably has something to do with Cloverfield. And we're all like, what does it all mean? But at the end of the day, very little in terms of that marketing campaign meant anything in relation to the rest of the film.
I remember coming over to your house daily, and Caleb would have something new like, okay, I've made some progress.
Yeah.
And we'd have to go through it, you know, a couple times a week.
Yeah, it was like Cloverfield Central there for a while. Yeah, I don't know. And it ended up not really being worth anything. Kind of like the new Cloverfield film.
Yeah, that's what I heard.
Not really worth anything. I'll tell you what's more interesting, though, and this, before we go to the break here, there was a press release put out by Newcastle University, and this is really cool, and there were some photos that accompanied this. Their latest research in current biology apparently has to do with how 3D vision works, but not just with people. They were looking at 3D mantis vision, okay? And what they say that they have found is that it works differently from all previously known forms of biological 3D vision. This is what they say according to this press release. 3D or stereo vision helps us work out the distances to things that we see. Each of our eyes sees a slightly different view of the world, and our brains merge these two views to create a single image while using the differences between the two views to work out how far away things are. And of course, those who have suffered blindness, partial blindness, or you know, they lose vision in one eye, you can still see, but you lose some degree of depth perception, right? So stereoscopic vision allows us to see things in three dimensions, and we have depth as well as just being able to see stuff. Now, everything isn't just a great big cartoon, you know. There's depth to existence. But humans are not the only animals that have stereo vision. We've got a lot of other animals, of course, including monkeys, you know, our cousins. Then again, we could call cats, horses, owls, toads, all other kinds of things in the animal kingdom cousins in one way or another. But insects, okay, are a little different. Some guys, like spiders, which aren't insects, by the way, they're arachnids, but they have, well, lots of ocular sensory organs that are in one localized area, we might say. It is a little different with praying mantises. They have stereo vision. And so the team there at Newcastle University with their neuroscience division, okay, decided to investigate whether praying mantis 3D vision works the same way as ours does. And what they found, of course, is that not quite, and it's really interesting. To investigate this, they temporarily glue these little 3D glasses onto these guys. And so these mantises are walking around wearing these little, literally, I mean, like 3D glasses. It's quite awesome. In their insect 3D cinema, they could show the mantis a movie of tasty prey, apparently hovering right in front of the mantis. This illusion is so good that the mantises would actually try to catch it. The scientists could now show the mantises not only simple movies of bugs, but the complex dot patterns used to investigate human 3D. This enabled them to compare human and insect 3D vision for the first time. They say this is a completely new form of 3D vision, as it is based on change over time instead of static images. And this according to a behavioral ecologist, Dr. Vivek Nityananda at Newcastle University. In mantises, it is probably designed to answer the question, is there prey at the right distance for me to catch? So they see things in relation to how they change over time. That's pretty fascinating. That's not all that they're going to be working on with mantises. They say as part of the wider research, Newcastle University engineering students are right now developing an electronic mantis arm which mimics the distinctive striking action of the insect. A lot of people have talked about them being some of the most fascinating creatures, and James Wald over the weekend was telling me that he's always referred to the praying mantis as his spirit animal. But I think a lot of people have a unique affinity for praying mantises. I mean, there are a lot of interesting things about them. I know as a child, I was always drawn to mantises. And I remember there was this quote from a fella who, and this is really weird and esoteric, but I talk about this in Magic Mysticism of the Molecule. There was a guy who had said that as a child, he had captured a praying mantis in his hands. And that the mantis in his hands, it didn't try to struggle, didn't try to escape. And he opened his hands and he let the mantis go. But before it flew off, it looked at him. And he says it took a good moment just to kind of check him out. And then the mantis flies off. Later, this fella actually is a user of the very powerful hallucination dimethyltryptamine in one of these studies with the drug. And during his trip, what he describes seeing, and keep in mind, many people describe seeing mantis-like entities under the influence of especially dimethyltryptamine, but there are other instances where that particular archetype of the mantis, the alien mantis, fractal mantoid, appears. I've always been fascinated by the imagery of mantises or mantis-like creatures during hallucinations, but the guy said that in his hallucination, he didn't just see a mantis-like being. He said, in that experience that I had, I saw the mantis from my childhood. He said it was definitely more anthropomorphic in that vision, but he said I recognized it, and it looked at me, and it recognized and remembered me. Crazy stuff. I love those kind of stories, though. A little more in the way of news when we return here on the Grailian Report. High mountains of Appalachia. It is the Grailian Report, keeping you company every Monday night from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time, worldwide, around the globe via KGRARadio.com. Okay, so it's Valentine's Day almost. That's coming up this week. And you know what I always do on Valentine's Day, right? I stay in. I don't go out. I don't do anything. In fact, I hide. I'm certain that nobody in the listening audience of this program has Valentine's Day plans. I'm just kidding. It's a wonderful time of the year. I mean, and there's, I think the idea behind it is great, but I do get a little turned off by the corporate element of it. You know, everybody, let's rush out and spend gobs of money. And I think it's a good thing, you know, when you spend a lot of money on somebody that you care about, if it's a genuine show of affection. But I think that, I don't know, in some ways it just kind of turns into like this race, you know, or like this, I don't know, it's like a competition to see who can out-chocolate and rose everybody else. I mean, then again, there are some people who are like, you know, instead of just Valentine's Day, let's turn it into like a family night where we all kind of hang out. Or let's string into a thing where we intentionally boycott the corporate side of it and we stay at home and make soup and enjoy a movie together and deal with the things that matter the most, which is indeed, I think, often those ever important relationships we share with those that we care about. You know, lovers, spouses, even our kids, you know, I mean, just being able to share time together. But there have been some interesting studies and reports coming out, and one of them actually that appeared in the Journal of Social and Personal Relationships deals with the benefits of being single. And they report on this. They say it turns out if you're single, you probably hold stronger social bonds that help other people. What this study found is that marriage can actually constrain some people socially and is not always the happy ending that it is perceived as being. The single individuals are more likely to frequently stay in touch with, provide help to, and receive help from parents, siblings, neighbors, and friends than the married are. Very interesting, especially considering the fact that, you know, when you're married, I mean, your intention is generally that you are building a family. That may not be the only reason that some people get married, I guess, but, you know, I mean, often marriage is intended in, or rather in the eventual sense, has the idea of family in mind. And yet this study published in 2015 talks about the fact that those who are married are less likely to be able to or willingly provide help to parents, siblings, neighbors, and others. Another thing that people are being told to look out for this Valentine's Day, that is the rise of the zombie bots. And yeah, this is, as funny as this actually sounds, it has been reported by the New York Post that many experts are warning that there are going to be more bots this year targeting lonely single individuals via email, social media, and the like. Yeah, from this report, they said again that the zombie bots, they believe, are going to probably, actually the entire week, but really they're going to swarm, they say, on February 14th, according to IBM. And they say that IBM's X-Force warns since January 16th, that U.S. email inboxes have been inundated, and they estimate that 230 million dating spam messages have reached people in America alone. But that heading into Valentine's Day week, they're predicting a massive increase in the computer come-ons, and they've said that there are three things that people need to watch out for, these zombie bots, actually much worse than real zombies. They say the tips that you want to look out for to avoid becoming a victim. If you're the lonely single type at home on Valentine's Day and you receive electronic communications that seem friendly and perhaps positive or even hopeful as it comes to the amorous science, keep in mind that if you see bad grammar, that is definitely a warning sign. If you see something that's too good to be true, like someone saying, I must say you're very cute and I'd really like to know you more.
Because nobody would say that otherwise.
That's right. At least they wouldn't say it that way. You see, that's the sad thing is somebody's going to finally work up the nerve and they're going to reach out to somebody this week. They're going to have heard us talk about it on this program. And that vigilant listener is going to say, no, I know this is a spam. You can't trick me. And then some poor love-struck Hadel somewhere is going to crawl back off into his or her dark corner of the inner earth alone.
It's sad, you know. Technology seems to be ruining us in that regard, doesn't it?
Well,
you know, now we can just swipe left or right to determine whether we like somebody or not. So
I'm with you, Matt. I know exactly what you mean. But now there's one more point that I've got to make, too. And this is the third and perhaps the most important way that you can ward off potential attacks from zombie bots this Valentine's Day. Okay, be on the lookout especially for an email return address that differs from the arrival address. That's right. Those are the things that you need to watch out for so as to prevent the zombie bots attacking you this Valentine's Day. I mean, again, I love the idea behind it, but Lauren was looking into that a little too, and she was telling me, I'm not a huge fan of Valentine's Day, and I've been trying to explain to my children, of course, you know, why we do this, why we give cards. And she said, you know, I wanted to try and tie in, you know, something historical so I could make it educational. And she said, and then I'll look into some of the history of Valentine's Day, and I actually didn't want to have to share that with my kids. They're not really ready for that. So, I don't know. It's just one of those holidays that, to me, in recent times, it has become so superficial.
It has, but a lot of our society has, as I was illustrating with the dating apps and things like that, you know.
Oh, yeah.
You see a picture of somebody and you literally swipe right for, I don't know how it goes, right for left for yes or no.
This is why I don't use the dating apps. And actually, I've had people come back and say, well, Micah, while you're disparaging dating apps, just remember that some people use these and we like using them. And that they have actually introduced us to some great people. I mean, I got to tell you, for instance, I don't think she would mind me naming her. I mean, Shannon LeGros, my good friend, you know, of course, who does Into the Fray. We got to get her back on Graylian sometime soon. She and I were chatting on the phone the other day and going over, you know, actually just, you know, research and business related stuff. And Shannon actually mentioned to me, she said, you know, back in my dating day, she said, I had used a dating site. And that was the best thing about it was, you know, of course, I didn't end up with any of those people, but I met so many new individuals, and it was so nice and so fun, you know, just getting to meet people. And one of the benefits of, maybe not all dating apps do this, again, you know, I think you're talking about Tinder with the swipe
left. Is
that
what it is? I've known people who've used it, and I just think it's the most, you know, vapid thing that you could possibly do to a person.
I'm in complete agreement with you. You know, we judge the person based, I mean, again, first of all, that is the definition of superficial. I look at a picture of someone and then I vote yay or nay on an app. But some of the apps actually do put people in touch with someone based on common likes.
Yeah.
You know, a number of different factors. And that's kind of cool because it also allows you the opportunity before you go out and meet that person, either in a bar or via a blind date, you know, that you've been set up with, you know, by a family member or a jealous coworker who's actually trying to, in some way, hijack your life. I don't know.
Or a zombie.
Yeah. I mean, one of the benefits of seeing someone on a dating app is that you at least have their name and some general information about them, first of all, and then you can kind of, you know, do your own online check because, come on, let's face it, in this information age of social media, yeah, if you get a random friend request from anybody, you know you're all doing that. You're going out there and you're finding out who this person is, if you can, before you accept that friend request. I have to do it, too. You know, of course, being the media personality that I am.
Yeah, and everybody wants to be your friend. So
everybody wants to be my friend, yeah. Well, I like being friends with people, too. So, okay, Matt, I know you've been watching the Tesla launch, SpaceX, all this. There's been a lot going on with this. And, you know, one person had actually asked recently, I saw, you know, Elon Musk put a car in space. Is this an engineering achievement or is this art? Well, there are a lot of questions that are coming to mind about this. And here in a minute, maybe we'll get into some private space program stuff. I don't know. What have your observations been, though, while you've been watching SpaceX? Big news, of course, with the Falcon feat right here. And some are saying this may just be a prelude to bigger things yet to come.
Oh, yeah. There is no shortage of opinions on this project here. I had to throw the Flat Earth one in the show notes page. I'm sure
yes,
you saw.
I saw, yes. The Flat Earthers, of course, saying that the latest rocket launch was a hoax.
I watched it, and I admittedly made a satirical post that night. I said, you know, I was really excited about this, and then here they are just showing me stills from the new Heavy Metal live-action remake.
Actually, I saw that, and that was funny. That was funny as hell.
Yeah, you know.
Although I will say you're no longer a skeptic, obviously. You've lost some of your skeptic pizzazz.
Oh, and, have I?
Yeah, yeah. You've gone from being a skeptic to a cynic.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But well, anyway.
I don't know. Is that leveling up or leveling down?
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I don't know. We'll put that one to the listeners.
Yeah, we'll have to figure that out. I think it's really interesting. And you brought up the art angle. I actually hadn't seen anybody really try and assess this as art yet. I think it's more of a kind of look at me, maybe a you know, trophy of his achievement as an individual, more than anything. But I think it's very interesting, and I think it brings up quite a few discussions we should have as a society in general. You know, there I saw articles about bringing it back to the pollution angle, here we throw our garbage in rivers and oceans. Now we're going to start doing it in space. Because for all intents and purposes, that really is what we could be doing.
Well, we're already doing a lot of that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
There's a lot of garbage in space already.
So there's that angle to look at it from, but then there's also something else I put in the show notes page, the privatization of space. Did we ever think we'd get to that point, you know?
Well,
new frontier.
The new frontier would become privatization of space. Again, you know, we have long been in this position, and when people like to refer to Bob Bigelow as the UFO nut who had that National Institute for Discovery Science and, you know, been taking government money to the overwhelming amounts of million. You know, I mean, it was a gnat that landed in somebody's beverage. That's what that amounts to in terms of typical government spending. I mean, $22 million to anybody else would be significant. But yeah, in terms of government appropriation for projects and things like this, this wasn't very much. Bigelow has also put a lot of his personal funding into UFO research over the years. I'll say that too. But the broader point I want to make is that before you try to discredit this guy as being some lone nutcase who's been interested in UFOs, so crazy that Harry Reid decided to actually appropriate some funding to that research and actually put Bigelow behind some of the outreach and civilian effort on that front as well, you got to keep in mind that NASA has been outsourcing to Bigelow Aerospace for years with a number of different projects. One of the most fascinating things that Bigelow had been working on, as far as the privatization of space goes, was this inflatable space station, something that could be very economically carried into orbit and then partially assembled due to its ability to be inflated in space. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, true innovation right there. Again, with space, as much as we love what we see in the films, you know, in science fiction films, like my new favorite one, the Cloverfield thing, you know, I mean, as much as we love the idea of these great big massive, you know, constructed space stations that are like something out of Star Trek or Star Wars, I mean, and it has almost everything, in fact, to do with efficiency. Getting into space is all about, you know, you need the amount of thrust requisite to get out of Earth's atmosphere, and then from there, what you're going to try and do is use the natural, you know, gravitational forces exerted by planets and other bodies to propel yourself through space with as little effort and energy as you can to get there and then to get back. And this is part of the reason why. I mean, there are incredible, almost insurmountable hurdles that come into play along the way. And this is why many have said, if we go to Mars and there's going to be any kind of, you know, a realistic expectation to do any kind of serious research there, it's going to, A, be a one-way trip, which means, B, it's going to have to be a colonization right from the outset, a small Martian colony, and that we send people up there with no realistic expectation of being able to bring them home, but with the eventual hope that there will be advancements and achievements that will be capable of it maybe one day doing so. So imagine people go and they are the first colonists on Mars, and they don't really think they're ever going to come home. And over the course of several decades, through advancements in knowledge and experience and infrastructure and materials and engineering, maybe that the private, private space groups and engineering groups and aerospace divisions and companies produce, maybe that eventually those people would be able to come home and you know, again, live again here on planet Earth. That's truly sci-fi to me.
And I do agree that the private sector has had a lot of, you know, innovation over the years. There's no doubt about that. History proves that that is the case. However, on a new frontier like this, are we willing to allow people? See, this is the same. I don't know if you recall. I'm sure you do. Asgardia, right? The first space nation. You remember these people who are supposedly going up and making their own country in space? And I think it brings forth a lot of ethical questions that we have to address before people just start launching their own rockets into space and creating their own nations, and we make the rules in this sector. Yeah, I don't think that we are approaching this in a good philosophical manner at the moment.
Well, I hope that someone will, Matt. Does that make you feel better?
I I can hope in one hand as well.
I guess you can.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Now, yeah, the flat earthers, though. That's the hilarious part. Yeah. Here's the, never gets old. Well, here's the weird thing about all that. The flat earthers tried to build their own rocket, and the thing won't launch. So I think that there's a bit of envy here. I think that's what this really comes down to. They see somebody else launch their rocket and actually takes off. And so
rocket envy.
Rocket envy, yeah. Rocket envy, that's exactly what it is, Matt. Because, you know, I mean, one guy got his rocket up and the other one didn't.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's the problem. So the flat earthers, they just got to be the naysayers. The internet trolls. Ladies and gentlemen, we're trying to maintain our responsible broadcast initiative here.
That's right.
So it's almost time for us to move on to other things. But, oh, boy. I tell you, you know, maybe we've got time to go ahead and get into this. Because in the second hour, I want to kind of diverge off into the realm of myth and tradition, but I want to kind of kick things off with a missing person report. And then I want to ask a very important question that I think is on a lot of people's minds, and I don't think it's crazy, and it does have to do with, are there patterns that relate to disappearances that occur in some of our national parks? This is not a crazy, you know, thing. I mean, whether this can be related to predatory animals, or perhaps predatory animals that walk on two legs, or whether it can be related to other things. Again, you know, this is, and of course, we're obviously talking about David Pilatus and the crux of his Missing 411 book series. And some people, you know, they attack him and say, oh, he just cherry picks the data and he's trying to be sensational without really being sensational. He leaves a lot to the mind. But when he leaves so much to the imagination with the books by not coming to conclusions, to me, that's what a responsible researcher does try to do. They try to maintain a certain degree of sympathy, and I think that there's a finesse to that in terms of reporting on people who often go missing. Sometimes bodies are found and loved ones are lost. Well, David has sat down with numerous families and interacted with them, and a lot of these families appreciate, you know, and strongly support the work that he does. So for people who want to attack him, I say, well, first of all, you got to keep in mind a lot of the people who he discusses and talks about with these, you know, in his books. They are supporters of his work because of the way he's gone about it and the way that he's reached out to them. So, I mean, one might make the argument that, well, this seems a little spooky and mysterious, and after all, he is writing books about it. But the whole reason he began to write these books really had to do with National Park officers or park rangers, rather, coming to him at one point and saying, this is something that, you know, we would love someone with a law enforcement background like you to look into, and the Park Service isn't talking about it. It's something that needs to be addressed. So we'll delve into a little of that later. But one of the stories that Lauren sent along this week involves a mystery that has fascinated me for a very long time. I've even written articles about this. And it involves what is known as the Screaming Mummy. It was a mummy that was found in Egypt. And, of course, when it was recovered, unlike a lot of mummies, which appear to have been, again, embalmed and put through this kind of, you know, preservation process, this mummy was found with his head turned backward, his mouth wide open. He appears to be screaming in agony. And so there were a lot of considerations and questions. Was this an individual who had been buried alive, tortured, poisoned? I mean, what in the world could have happened with this individual? Now, the Sun reports that over the years, various theories have been aired in an attempt to reveal not only what the cause of death might have been, and whether this individual and their mummified remains represent someone who died in agony, but also who this person was. And one popular theory was that it was Prince Pentewe, the son of Pharaoh Ramses III. The prince unsuccessfully plotted to kill his father and take his throne, and according to ancient records, they say, was made to take his own life after the plan failed and then was put on trial. But the latest theory that has emerged casts doubt on that explanation, and this is what they're saying. According to Dr. Bob Breyer, he's an archaeologist at the University of Long Island in New York, he's examined the remains of the screaming mummy, and he says there were two forces that were acting on this mummy, one to get rid of him and the other to try and preserve him. Zahi Hawass also comes into this, former antiquities minister from the Egyptian Supreme Council of Antiquities. He says it's likely that the mummy was a prince who brought shame on his family. I wonder what the basis for that is. He believes that.
He says that the body was covered in sheepskin, apparently.
Yeah.
And that when one is covered with sheepskin, they are perceived to be unclean.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
I see. Okay. I have a quote from him here. He says, in the mind of the ancient Egyptian, to cover with a sheepskin means he was not clean, that he did something bad in his life. We'd never seen a mummy like this suffering. It's not normal, and it tells us something happened, but we did not know exactly what. So Dr. Breyer says that for some reason there was an attempt to make sure that he didn't have an afterlife, and in another attempt somebody cared about him and yet tried to override that. Yeah. And they say that this week, apparently, the screaming mummy is on display at the Egyptian Museum in Cairo for the first time. Never been on display there before. I have seen photographs of the screaming mummy before, and I would love to be able to see the actual, I mean, the real McCoy. But unfortunately, I can't get over there in time to be able to do so. Although I'll also say that really, I mean, many people who would normally be apt to travel to the Middle East these days feel a little less certain about that kind of travel due to the political tensions in that region. It's such a shame. And once again, that's something that came up with Jason and James and I, the Seven Ages guys, over the weekend. We all have had this long-held fascination with Egypt. I would love to go over there and do one of those guided tours where you spend several days out there on the Giza Plateau and seeing some of the ancient monuments and the sites, absorbing that culture and learning about the ancient way of life there in one of the great ancient civilizations. I mean, the height of civilization in the ancient world. And, you know, whether you prescribe to these ideas that, you know, some of the temple complexes, the Sphinx itself and other things may have been older and that there's geological evidence that supports it. I think that there's a strong case to be made there as far as the geology, but I still wonder about some of the dates and times and this and that. But however you look at that, I think we all agree on one thing without question, and that is that, I mean, no place in the ancient world, with maybe the exception of parts of ancient Greece, no place has captured the imagination quite like ancient Egypt has. And that is truly a fascinating place. I do sincerely hope that certain tensions in the region stabilize and the threat of terror and other concerns are not imminent always and forever in the future, because I really want to get to Egypt at some point, spend some time there in the land of the pharaohs and study the ancient traditions and culture there. Truly captivating place. Okay, when we come back, we're going to touch on some listener emails, look at a strange disappearance, and then look at also the myth and history of the Woodwose and the Wild Man. It is the Grailian Report. We'll be back right after this.
Exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grailian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
Broadcasting live from the darkest corner of the web, I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Grailian Report. Keeping you company every Monday night from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time via KGRARadio.com. Glad as always to be in pocket with you guys. I can't help but profess fascination with some of the mythic reports of wild hairy humanoids that go back to antiquity. I mean, and there are a lot of different ways that can be interpreted and why that archetype exists. We're going to look at a little of that later in this hour. And as promised, of course, one of the strangest missing person cases probably ever to have occurred. But I think it's only fair to spend a little time discussing that, which we've touched on quite a few times in the past. But as author David Politis and others have put forth in their writings on this subject, ideas like clusters of disappearances and things from time to time also come into discussion. So we'll look at that also. Listener emails, news, and views also. But before we get to all that, I do want to take just a moment to remind you, if you are not yet a subscriber, it's easy to do, it's fun, and it'll get you access to all different kinds of goodies. Just head over to GrailianReport.com/X. That's where you can sign up at $7 a month or $77 a year. And keep in mind, too, that if you like podcasts, we spoke to a lot of people at the Artifact Show in Greenville, North Carolina over the weekend, because, of course, I took all the gear down there, and Jason and James and I are doing live podcasting from the event. And a lot of folks that were there said, gosh, you know, I've always wanted to do a podcast. It's cool. You guys are doing an archaeology, history, and anthropology podcast. And I keep getting such wonderful emails from people who I mean, again, a much more kind of academically themed subject like that, I wasn't sure how it would be received, but I have gotten some wonderful emails from people about the Seven Ages audio journal. It's on iTunes, but just head over to sevenages.org, completely free, biweekly podcast. We put one out about twice a month, or depending on how the weeks fall, maybe you'll get three. But we featured some great interviews. We're going to feature, in fact, actually at sevenages.org, front and center, the first thing you'll see is a video. So if you like video, we've got an actual video of us discussing, kind of bridging the gap between the archaeological community and the collectors, people who want to collect and sell artifacts versus those who want to study them and put them in museums. How can we bridge that gap? I mean, if you think about it, some of the best films that really kind of romanticize that subject of archaeology, Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade and all these kind of things, I mean, that's the same sort of thing. Collectors and adventure versus this, what's often perceived, and I think sometimes unfairly, as being a stuffy sort of academia. And they're always wrong about what's happening. The real history of the earth has to do with this or that or some crazy idea. It's not always crazy ideas. And in truth, sometimes academicians are wrong about things. I mean, and they'll be the first to tell you that. So the idea with the whole Seven Ages audio journal is not to just play into, again, people's fascination with ancient astronaut theories, or the idea that there was a lost civilization 10, 20,000 years ago. I mean, those things, I'll admit, are very fascinating subjects. Whether or not they're true, I still think that they're entertaining. And maybe there'll be good evidence forthcoming that will shed some light and perhaps point to the veracity of some of those kinds of claims. I don't know. Well, that's what science is for. But the idea with the Seven Ages Audio Journal is to look scientifically at the subject of history and archaeology and to try and present a rational and balanced view on these things. My co-hosts Jason Pentrail and James Waldo do a fine job. Again, guys who are very well credentialed in their own disciplines. Jason being an environmental science scientist with a master's degree and also a bachelor's degree in that field. And then, of course, James Waldo, who's been a professional geologist with the Army Corps of Engineers for a number of years. So two guys who are highly credentialed and yet for some reason still lend their assistance to my ongoing endeavors to get to the heart of the matter, the main nerve, and frankly, just the truth that underlies human origins and where we all come from and what it means to be human, both in terms of space and time. And really, that's what archaeology does. It looks at the spatial and the temporal relationships as it looks at humanity and where we've come from and how we've gone about existence here on Terra Firma. Fascinating stuff. So do check out sevenages.org, some videos, some audio, lots of articles and other good stuff there, completely for free. And I think you'll enjoy it. Getting to the listener emails here, Matt writes, Micah, I follow your work and listen to the Graylian Report from time to time. I listened to your Halloween episode a couple of months ago, and I really enjoyed it. Boy, he's got some catching up on podcasts to do.
Yeah, apparently. And this isn't me, by the way. Yeah, boy, I didn't write this.
He's just a funny man tonight, Mr. Oakley here. Oh, he's our comic relief. That's good. Some weeks you need a little of that. Maybe a little more than others. So anyway, Matt, the other Matt, we'll call him Faker Matt, or no, that sounds bad. No, yeah. I was thinking of Faker He-Man, you know, like He-Man back in the old days. I was a big He-Man fan. There's the good He-Man and there was the blue He-Man who was evil and they called him Faker He-Man. But I don't think he'd appreciate being called Faker Matt. So yeah. Obviously Matt Oakley is the fake and this is the real Matt. We finally have heard from the real Matt after all this time.
I've been wondering where he is.
So Matt, he says, I listened to your Halloween episode. Really enjoyed it. You probably know this, but I thought I would share anyway. On the episode, you talked a little about some strange happenings on Lake Lanier in Georgia. Now, this made me think of some similar stories a little closer to home. My dad, who is not a fan of or believer in the paranormal, had fished Fontana Lake for 30 years. That's right up the road here, Matt. He's always talked about weird stories about this lake, including strange sightings, rumors of huge catfish near the dam, graveyards underneath the water, and numerous other bizarre tales. I'm sure that's true, by the way, and we can talk more about that here in a second. He says, I'm sure you're aware that two towns were flooded in the early 1900s to make way for the lake during the war effort. Remains do indeed still exist beneath the water, including graveyards and old abandoned buildings and homes in the nearby woods. There's also been rumors of disappearances in these woods in the Smoky Mountains National Park. It all kind of lends itself to legends and lore of this lake an hour west of Asheville. Another local connection, Lake Lanier, is named after the famous poet Sidney Lanier. Sydney died in a home in western North Carolina near Tryon. Something to ponder on. Greetings from a fellow Asheville-ian, Matt Garrison. Matt, he lives... Faker Matt, I mean.
We know Matt Garrison.
Oh, of course. We do. Yeah. We do, absolutely. I was going to say, though, but see, there has to be a street fight now between you and he to determine who indeed the real Matt is.
I don't know that I can do that now. After we've traded drinks, or we've had drinks together.
I know. Yeah, exactly. So anyway, Matt, all kidding aside, it's really good to hear from you, everybody. And yeah, Fontana fascinates me. It, again, a man-made lake. And of course, in order to make it, they flood a valley, including the homes, the graveyards under it. And yes, its proximity to the Great Smoky Mountains National Park, where there have been some very strange disappearances that have occurred. Trini Lee Gibson was a young lady who disappeared back in the 1970s, if memory serves. She was walking near Black Balsam with a group of around 15 or 20 other individuals. Trini had gotten a little distance away from the rest of the group, but those who saw her last said that they saw her seem to stop and bend over like she's looking at something off the trail. She steps off the trail for a moment and is never seen again, alive or dead. That was, again, the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. But the one that really stands out the most, of course, is Dennis Lloyd Martin, the young boy who vanished there. We've talked about it numerous times on this program, so I don't want to get into the details of that case. It's heartbreaking. So much so that, I mean, it's, and Lauren and I have talked about this numerous times, and actually earlier today as we were kind of getting ideas together for tonight's show, she and I, we were on the telephone, and that subject came up again today. And it's hard to avoid it when you're looking at these kinds of things. I think that, and I've heard also that there's a new documentary that deals with the Dennis Lloyd Martin case. I mean, it's something that's very concerning. And some of the questions that David Politis and other researchers have raised about these kind of cases, they say so some weird things. First of all, Dennis Lloyd Martin is one of two instances in the broader array of these missing person cases where the Green Berets become involved in the search. But also, the FBI, they typically don't handle missing person cases, but when it comes to missing children, it's absolutely a situation. And see, David Politis has often asked questions about that and why it's specific to missing children. But, you know, again, if I were to look at that, one way I would interpret that myself, which I'm sure David's probably thought of and others too, if a child is abducted, again, it's one thing if a grown, you know, person, you know, acting of their own accord, you know, if they befall certain circumstances and become, a casualty of an abduction and they are apprehended, that's one thing. But when it happens to a minor, this is, of course, it's not only a much more concerning issue, but there are the myriad concerns that are associated with everything from human trafficking to also carrying a person against their will across state lines. All of the aforementioned being things that naturally the Federal Bureau of Investigation is going to be interested in and become involved with. And with the Dennis Lloyd Martin case, Jim Reich was the FBI agent who was overseeing that from the Knoxville branch of the FBI. And he ended up committing suicide a number of years later, which many have said is mysterious, but unfortunately it may have been more as a result of his general line of work, not just that case. But yeah, he had been involved with the Dennis Lloyd Martin case. He had, in fact, Jim Reich, the late FBI agent, had been the agent who interviewed Harold Key, the man who said that he and his family saw the rough-looking, dark-figured man up there on the hill about 9 miles from where Dennis went missing the very same day, and actually just an hour after Dennis first vanished. And so it's understanding why these cases and the loose threads that they leave, why they interest us. But as Politis points out in some of his research, there are some cases that, I mean, admittedly, they are stranger. They really are stranger than just a person is walking down a trail, they go missing, and they're never seen again. I want to give you an example. This involves a case that it transpired at Mount Rainier, Washington, but the guy who went missing was one of the most experienced mountain climbers in his area of technical climbing. He disappeared while mountain climbing with friends who were assisting with the climb. I mean, again, I'm not going to say anything else. I've got an audio soundbite, in fact, where Politis is talking about this with the journalist George Knapp. Listen to the way he frames this case. Ask yourself the questions that naturally come to mind. When a man is mountain climbing, he is harnessed. His friends are pulling him up the mountain. They feel the line, which is normally taut, go loose. There's nobody on the other side of the line. And then Eric goes missing.
I like to talk about things that are really, really abnormal. And there was a guy named Eric Lewis. I don't know if you remember that one. It disappeared in July of 2010. 57 years old, absolutely phenomenal shape, climbed as a career all over the world, and was climbing with some super experienced climbers on the side of Rainier. And they were doing some technical climbing high up. They were pulling each other up, and Eric was on the other end, and all of a sudden the line kind of goes loose. So they pull it up, and the carabiner at the other end is there, but there's no rope attached to it. So they decide they'll go down, and because they're yelling for him, and they're not getting anything, and they can't see him. And we're talking about nothing unusual here. They're climbing the mountain. A guy's attached to the line. He's over the side of the cliff. He didn't fall. There's no screaming or yelling. There's nothing. They looked for him. They looked for him. They called in the National Park climbing team. This guy was never found. And he was attached, and they were starting to pull. The rope went limp. The carabiner's attached to the other end. Eric's gone and never seen again.
You say in the book that he was among the top 1% climbers in the world?
Per the National Park Service climbers that were there. They said he knew that mountain better than most of the professionals that climb it.
He would have had to have disconnected the rope himself on purpose, almost?
Yeah, exactly. It didn't break because it was never attached, and they said it made absolutely no sense.
That is such a strange case, again, that it's like he just fell off into nowhere. They never find the body.
See, I'm unfamiliar with this one. This is creepy almost.
Again, it were, and here's the thing. I'll point out that, for instance, in my opinion, and I'm speaking just professionally here, okay? In my opinion, there are certain things about the Dennis Lloyd Martin case that were not touched on in Missing 411 East Coast that needed to be. For instance, and actually primarily, the testimony given years later by a ginseng hunter who went to the park ranger named Dwight McCarter, who's referenced in that book by Pilatus, and Pilatus actually goes and meets him. There's a ginseng hunter that said that he found the remains of what appeared to be a child 3 miles from Rowan's Creek, which is much closer to where the child went missing than the child went missing from Spence Field. The sighting by Harold Key and his family occurred 9 miles away at Rowan's Creek. 3 miles away, roughly, the ginseng hunter, who was doing so illegally, back in the 1980s, said that he found what looked like the remains of a child. The bones, a skull, and some other bones scattered around an area. He tells Dwight McCarter a search ensues, but this is years after the fact, and they find nothing in the area where the ginseng hunter said that the remains were found. And so we may never know if that was indeed Dennis Martin, if those were his remains. You can only imagine what a family who loses their little boy like this must feel like. And that's why I think, you know, we have to address this with such care and concern. Graylian Report, we do have a video on our YouTube channel about the Dennis Martin case. But for that very reason, by the way, you know, some of our videos actually feature the AdSense program and stuff, and we don't put any ads on videos like that because I think it's important that if you're going to discuss something that's so sensitive like that, you know, you just put the information out there. And so that we did. And it, of course, is the most viewed video in all of our history. But again, one thing I would like to see, and Dwight McCarter said this too, is that the story of the ginseng hunter should be given more consideration. But there are other theories about what happened to that boy. Again, it's as sad as it is, it's a story that has just captured the imagination. But something else that we see, and there are so many other stories that really kind of, they catch our minds, they catch our attention, and not so much for the tragic nature or the mysteriousness, but just the genuine bizarre nature of what happened. There was another story that Pilatus talks about. And it's the other of the two reports in the United States that he dealt with where the Green Berets got involved. Again, there was a young man who goes missing out west. The body's never found, but the Green Berets come in, and instead of networking with and working with the rest of the search operation, like what happened with Dennis Martin, the Green Berets are out there doing their own search. They aren't communicating with the other searchers. It's like they're there on their own separate mission. And he talks about some of these cases. One of them that was really peculiar involved when the child went missing, they send out search dogs which pick up the scent and follow the scent all the way up a mountain, up into this very remote territory. The dogs go all the way up this mountain. They come all the way back down. At this point, the searchers are going, why in the world would this child have, how? Not only why, how would this child have gone all the way up this mountain and come back down? And it, and then the dogs are following the scent, and then all the way down the backside of this mountain, and then the scent leads to this swamp area. And then the dogs just sit down, and the dogs won't go into this swamp. But they, I mean, the searchers who were working with them said, we know these dogs. The dogs absolutely had the scent, but they get to this swamp, and the dogs won't go in. You know, I mean, we got to be careful not to read too much into this. And this is one of the things that people have brought up about David Paulides, of course, is that with missing 411, he intentionally, he will note patterns. He will note things that are consistent between the reports. And he, like he said in that audio soundbite, likes to talk about weird ones. I think he tries his best to handle them extremely responsibly. And I really commend him for that. A lot of people get frustrated that he doesn't say more about what they involve. And yes, he has, and this is public record, he's written books about Bigfoot in the past. So a lot of people look at Missing 411 as, well, he's trying to bring credibility to the subject of disappearances in the national parks, but he must think that Bigfoot is behind some of this. And at one point in that same interview that we played the soundbite from, George Knapp asks him, do you think that something is eating children out there in the national parks? Now, by something, let's be clear, we could mean any number of things. You don't have to go all in and say Bigfoot did it by any means. We could be talking about anything. And Paulides says, well, I think that, you know, this is something that some of the people who have been involved with the search and rescue and some of the park rangers I've talked with have been concerned about. Is there an animal? Is there a predator? Is there something? And this could be a known animal species. It's highly unlikely that it's an unknown animal species, but maybe we shouldn't rule anything out. But we absolutely have to think about that possibility. But it is interesting that, again, David Paulides, writing about this subject, has written about Bigfoot in the past. And some people think that Bigfoot is just silliness. Oh, gosh, you know, there's nothing to be seen here. Why would we even do ourselves the disservice of talking about Bigfoot? But I want to reference an article, okay, that appeared in the Times Standard. This is out of Eureka, by the way. Eureka Times Standards. Will Houston reporting. And this was from 2016. He said, whether the large hairy hominid known as Bigfoot truly roams the wilderness of Humboldt County hasn't deterred scores of enthusiasts and a television series from joining a nearly 60-year quest to find signs and footprints of the ever-elusive creature. But one local scientist and professor says the search for Bigfoot opens a larger discussion about what the science world deems worthy of research and what happens to those fields that fall into what he calls the crackpot realm. I'll pause here for a moment briefly and say, you remember we talked about Dr. John Bindernagle recently and how he'd said, if there's anything to see here, the science community's already made up its mind that it doesn't exist, and this may have a lot to do in terms of philosophy of science with the premature nature of the discovery rather than the unlikelihood of the existence of the creature. So let's return to the article here. And they're talking about Richard Stepp. He's not a biologist. He's a physics professor at Humboldt State University, a physics professor, and he says, and I quote, people have to understand so that if they come into the talk and make assumptions that scientists have looked into this in a big way and found nothing, and therefore very likely there's nothing to find, they would be making a mistake. This physics professor says, science has not gone into this in a big way, talking about Bigfoot. Okay. I want to skip ahead to where we get some more quotes from him here. Stepp said he grew up with a fascination of boats while living in Ohio near Lake Erie. His research of Viking ships made him question what he'd been taught in school, that explorer Christopher Columbus was the first to reach North America by crossing the Atlantic Ocean. If you look at Viking ships, he said they could have gone anywhere on Earth. They didn't sail as well as later ships, but they had oars. Yet previous any crossings before Columbus, they were considered to be crackpot. Of course, later in 1960s, historians find that Vikings indeed crossed the Atlantic Ocean, settled North America for a time, and by the time Matt that I was in grade school, we weren't taught that Columbus discovered America, we were taught that Leif Erikson had. And actually, there may have been plenty of others who made it over even earlier than that. He said, and again, coming back around to other discussions, Stepp says it finally hit me that they were making fun. Okay. He says, it occurred to me that it must be taboo, for instance, for a physicist to talk about UFOs, for instance, and I just couldn't believe it at first. He said, I spent a whole summer reading about UFOs because people started ridiculing me because I'd said, well, why? What's silly about this? I figured that if science is going to look away from these things, then who knows what might actually be there. So when he was hired, Stepp, by HSU in 1973 to teach physics, Stepp said he'd heard about Bigfoot for years and found it to be a perfect example to teach students about the boundaries of science and why some projects get grant funds while others don't. He said it was a perfect example of where the edges of science were and why those things were edges. Because I'm a physicist, he said it wasn't really damaging to my career to talk about Bigfoot. I wasn't a biologist. I didn't have anything at stake. But, he said, instrumental to the broader point, Bigfoot made a good case for why people need to study these kind of things. He says, I'm very interested in these subjects. And again, why wouldn't you be if you are a person who is interested in science? It reminds me of another paper, Matt, that was written, Bigfoot from a Physics Point of View. Okay. This paper was authored a number of years ago, I believe by a student. I'm just going to read the abstract really quickly. Some of the most interesting features of this mystery called Bigfoot revolve around the reputed size, agility, and strength of these rather ubiquitous creatures. Much has been written on these subjects by a wide variety of investigators, and the famous Patterson-Gimlin film confirms to believers, including this author, the distinctly large size of yet at least one specimen. Also, circumstantial, i.e. sighting evidence, abounds as to the supposed running speed and agility of these bipeds. He says this paper will attempt to produce estimates of Bigfoot's weight, circumferences, speed, strength, and agility based upon simple mathematical and biomechanical concepts with procedures not previously documented by other investigators. Of course, some reasonable assumptions have to be made throughout the discussion, but after all, we don't have one of these remarkable mammals to test. Finally, this essay will take a look at the probability of the existence of such unparalleled creatures based upon an uncomplicated statistical methodology. This article can be found at the BigfootEncounters.com website, but you know, I've heard people refer to it anecdotally as a humor piece. And the reason that they have enjoyed it so much over the years is they say this physicist, obviously just poking fun at the idea, lays out a beautiful discussion of why, again, physically there's nothing about Sasquatch that couldn't exist. But in truth, this guy identifies himself in the abstract as being among the believers. Again, you know, I try to walk that line just because we do need good physical evidence. But really, physically, there's not that much about a creature like Bigfoot that says it could not exist. And I'm always amazed, Matt, when I hear scientists saying, and this isn't an endorsement of the existence of Bigfoot so much as it is an observation about what I consider illogical attitudes among scientists. A creature like Bigfoot could never exist in a place like the Pacific Northwest. What would it eat if it lived there? But see, we talked about this with the Thunderbird report recently that came from Alaska. In Alaska and Pacific West, we have the largest elk species anywhere in North America, two of the largest bear species anywhere on the planet. In fact, the two largest exist in that part of the North American continent, which, of course, are the Kodiak bear and the polar bear. We have, among the various large animals that exist anywhere in the world, some of the largest salamanders in North America exist right there. I mean, some of the largest species of all different varieties, subset species, you know, families of Animalia exist in that part of the world. Why? Because the demands of that climate and the conditions of that terrain in that region demand it. Larger mass in order to be able to sustain themselves throughout the winter. And yes, like Ian Malkin said, life finds a way. These animals do. These large animal species that exist in that part of the world, they live, they survive. And when scientists say nothing that large could ever live there and find something, you know, have enough to eat.
Carl's Jr.
Well, the point is again, if anything, one might say that based on the other animals that exist in that region, it's the place that would be most likely if a creature like that were to exist. And that's a big if. But the other things they say is there's nothing in the fossil record. We talked about this again last week. Actually, it's come up several times in recent weeks, especially with the passing of John Bendernagel. But one of the other arguments that people often make, and this is the one that when we come back from this break, I want to address. People say, and again, there should be more in the historic record that deals with these creatures if indeed something like this creature could exist. But I actually want to present, and let's treat this as a hypothetical for the time being, but I want to present information when we come back that deals with possible evidence that does exist since antiquity, which may account for the existence of these creatures. Let's look at it. Let's keep our minds open when we return here on the Grayling Report. From the dark hills of Appalachia, we haven't gone missing 411 yet. It is the Grayling Report. I'm Micah. He's Matt. Quick shout out to everybody in the chat room. My brud from down south, Cam Hale of the Expanded Perspectives podcast, is hanging out in there. Also, my other brud, Jason Pentrail from Seven Ages. He's hanging out there in the live chat tonight. My lovely assistant is in there, as always, helping corral Matt. But Matt, of course, is doing a fine job moderating the chat. Everybody, Adam K. Olson, Mr. Bill the Skywatcher there, our professor of proof reading himself.
We even had Mr. Nasty for a moment there, but I don't know what happened to him.
Oh no, Mr. Nasty has gone missing 411. Jeremy, I hope you're still out there. Anybody heard from him? It's good to see all you guys out there in the chat room. Glad to have you on board as always. And if you're one of the listeners out there of the podcast who has not joined us live on Monday nights, it's easy to do. Just head over to kgraradio.com/chat. Okay. So, we've got so much to cover, so little time. Matt, let's get into this here. We have discussed, again, the disappearances in the national parks. And, of course, David Politis and his, again, I think it's safe to say controversial research into this subject. Perhaps more controversial due to the interpretations by others than by the actual reporting that David himself has done. And who has, again, he's gone to great lengths, lots of travel. I think probably a lot of blood, sweat, and tears has gone into trying to cover this subject and to try and bring some attention, but also some merit to the report without going down the crazy ladder, you know, keeping it open-ended and trying to just analyze the report. So, again, it's a fascinating subject, but when it does come back around inevitably to this discussion of a alleged mystery hominid that exists in North America, and again, I'm not somebody who has to say so that I can fit into the friendly camp that, oh, of course, this thing doesn't exist. I'm not so sure. I mean, again, some recent footage that we were looking at, the Grayling team, the Seven Ages team, and I, we're all kind of really one big awesome team,
one family.
Yeah, we're all one family, you know. But this is a piece of footage from Tunica, Mississippi, that Lauren found that we've been doing a lot of research groundwork into, trying to find some context for this film. And as with a lot of the great pieces of footage that supposedly show these creatures, it's harder to get details about when and where the footage was made, how it was processed. Like the Patterson-Gimlin film, this was one of the perennial issues with that film. And much like the Patterson-Gimlin footage, this thing that was filmed in Mississippi by a guy identifying himself on YouTube as Josh Highcliffe, people have been looking for years. The footage looks so good. It's, I'd say, the second best to the Patterson-Gimlin footage that I've ever seen in my life. And Matt, actually, if you want to see it really quickly, I'm telling you what I'm going to do. For everybody at home, I'm just going to pop that into the chat room there really quickly. This is the footage that Lauren found. Kudos to my lovely assistant. Everybody right there in the chat room, you can click that link. Turn down the volume. Well, you're going to want to hear the volume, but you're listening to this show right now. So for the time being, you may just watch the video, but later be sure and listen to the volume too, with the volume up, because some of the sounds you're hearing are quite good too. This is not a convincing piece of footage in my mind. It is an intriguing piece of footage. I'll call it that. Intriguing enough that I have watched it several times, but it alone, I don't think any video, however good it looks, alone will convince the the scientific community, we're going to need a lot more than a good-looking piece of footage. But again, it is intriguing, and we'll leave it at that. But to the question of, well, where is the historical precedent for the existence of creatures like this? Are you looking at the video, Matt?
I am, yeah.
It's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
It's interesting.
I'm curious as to why there's no zoom button. I guess there may be fully zoomed in at this point.
Well, I've got a MacBook, and so we've got a zoom on this. So even though the operator of the camera couldn't, I can. And we watched it the guys and I, we watched it on the big screen. They indulged my interest in this. And again, it is at least interesting. But enough about that for the time being. We'll link that in the show notes for folks who catch the podcast and would like to check it out. If we look back through history, people say, well, there's very little in the way of historical data that supports the existence of these creatures. I would beg to differ. And I'm not just talking about, of course, the accumulation of North American Indian legends, you know, since colonization by Europeans of North America. I'm also referring to certain documents, certain narratives, certain mythologies. And yes, we have to recognize them as being simply that, mythologies. But if we're to be open-minded, suspend your disbelief if you're not a believer in this subject, as I'm going to do right now. I'm going to treat this as though, okay, well, let's say that something does exist. Let's look at these mythologies and let's look for some interesting parallels and some, you know, points of interest that arise. So let's start with the Epic of Gilgamesh, okay? And those of you who are familiar with the Epic of Gilgamesh, of course, will remember the character Enkidu, or Enkidu. And essentially, he's a wild man. He's put on Earth, of course, to help the hero Gilgamesh learn humility. And when he dies, of course, Gilgamesh weeps over his body. And he's almost more like a brother. And according to some translations and accounts, Enkidu almost resembles Gilgamesh. But I was interested in the name because, again, the narrative entails that Enkidu is this wild man. And in likelihood, the symbolism here, and there's so much more that we could say about the symbolism of what's happening in the narrative of Gilgamesh and what it means in terms of the formation of our attitudes and really of culture in general in ancient times. And the symbolism, what these things are actually meant to portray, and I think we should caution looking at the presence of a wild man in this story as being purely matter-of-factly, well, this was the Chewbacca to Han Solo. This was, you know, a Sasquatch. But again, really, that right there, that may not be a horrible comparison. We see Han Solo and his Sasquatch-esque friend who is indebted to, you know, protect him as a personal debt that he owes to him, or so he feels according to Wookiee tradition. I mean, again, these, and that's the whole thing that Joseph Campbell talked about, which George Lucas was so deeply influenced by, these parallels and these consistencies that emerge in mythologies over time. But I did find it interesting that Enkidu's name sometimes is compared with the deity, okay, Enkimdu, which means the Lord of the Reed Marsh, or according to some interpretations, Enki has created. But Lord of the Reed Marsh, that's so interesting because as we will find and as we will continue to see, often historically and leading right up to more recent times, this idea of the Sasquatch or the wild man is representative of a mythological outsider. And they are often, in terms of their habitat, even in these mythological representations, they are associated with swamps or mires, boggy areas where these beasts reside. I found it interesting that Enkidu, again, that name etymologically has relationship with the idea of this Lord of the Reed Marsh. That just fascinates me. Because if we step over, let's look at, again, Beowulf and Grendel, the character from Beowulf, who's coming down and he is wreaking havoc on the kingdom. And I've looked at very deeply into this, in the various translations and the descriptions that are given of Grendel, often they don't say much more than the fact that his shape was like a man, but he's larger than a man, and he's an outsider, and he lives, again, in a marshy area. And there was a long essay that I was composing a while back where I made the association between the story of Beowulf and his fighting off Grendel and the legend of Boggy Creek. Again, this idea of this this creature that just wants to be left alone but lives off in this marshy area. And, of course, those who've seen the famous drive-in theater film, Legend of Boggy Creek, that Charles B. Pierce directed, the climax of the film involves the creature allegedly coming and attacking a house and its inhabitants. And this is a motif that, although seldom, does appear, and it reoccurs in certain Sasquatch mythologies of more recent time that involve, again, this creature, the outsider, that just wants to be left alone. But as the encroachment of humankind against nature continues, the creature finally comes into the sphere of habitation that is shared between that creature and its wild property, if you want to call it, and humans and where they're settling. And a clash emerges. This idea of man versus wild, I think many modern scholars would see it as purely that, you know, what these creatures, these Grendels, these Enkidus, you know, these Boggy Creek beasts, they are representative of humankind and its conflict with nature, urban sprawl, these kind of things. Very seldom would it be looked at as being something that mythologically, historically, or otherwise, there's a physical truth to. But again, I wonder, should we not look a little bit more deeply? I think about things like the King's Mirror, and I've written a lot of articles over the years about this. This, of course, is a document from around 1250, and it's in the Old Norse, of course, means King's Mirror, but the document, of course, being from that part of the world, bears a lot of cultural themes and, of course, is written in a language that's entirely different from what we know today. It covers everything from politics to morality, the state, but the King's Mirror talks about a lot of unusual things, too, including in a portion titled The Natural Wonders of Ireland, the following account, which is really quite bizarre, and I'm going to read it verbatim, according to English translations. It once happened in that country, Ireland, and this seems indeed strange, that a living creature was caught in the forest as to which no one could say definitely whether it was a man or some other animal, for no one could get a word from it or be sure that it understood human speech. It had the human shape, however, in every detail, both as to hands and face and feet. But the entire body was covered with hair, as the beasts are, and down the back it had a long, coarse mane like that of a horse, which fell to both sides and trailed along the ground when the creature stooped in walking. I believe I have now recounted most of the marvels that have their origin in the nature of the land itself, so far as we seem to have sure knowledge concerning them. And then the author concludes that portion of the narrative. But it's a very strange report of something that they said was shaped like a human, covered in hair, had the long hair that was similar to the coarse hair of a horse's mane that ran down its back, and it stooped as it walked. And that they looked at it and said, we weren't sure if this was a human or an animal. It was shaped like a human, but behaved more like an animal. What was this? 1250. You know, again, this is, you know, a very interesting account to come from the Middle Ages. And we think about, again, in England, there's a long history of these wild people that were referred to as woodwosses in England. And I've seen wood cuttings and engravings and things like this. One of the most famous shows a knight actually in battle in a forest against a man of large proportions. He's a large man covered in hair. He has a beard, and he's defending himself against the sword-wielding knight with a uprooted tree. He's uprooted an entire tree, and he's battling this knight with a tree. I'm thinking it's Alan a Dale, obviously. Although, again, maybe the character there would more closely resemble Little John, but it's obviously not anything from the Robin Hood mythos. What we're seeing here is a clear depiction of what is recognized in British folklore as a woodwose, an iteration of the green man, which, again, this concept of a wild man, many say, is, again, just entirely representative of the mythic tradition of, again, you know, well, any number of things, but we've already touched on a lot of them here. And I wonder about that. The woodwoses in England were the strange man-like thing found in ancient Ireland, you know, the Beowulf, Enkidu from the Epic of Gilgamesh, and then, of course, yes, and we have to say the Native American legends, right on up to the period of colonization and the frontiersmen who were heading out further west, and they were categorizing and collecting these stories, and they were chronicling tales of these things that they said that the various native tribes of the Pacific Northwest especially called stealers of men. The Siatics or other names were attributed to them, but they said that there were what were sometimes they were referred to in English as stick Indians in reference to stick or wood, basically people who lived in the forest, and they called them stick Indians. But they said these were primitives, covered in hair. They lived ferally, and they lived off in the forest, much larger than the various Native American tribes. And they said that according to all the natives, that these things would come in the night. They would often steal food, and yes, they were even known to steal people. They would carry off women to have as wives. Things like this, stealers of men.
I think even if you don't believe in a physical manifestation of some sort of creature like this, you have to acknowledge that obviously, as we've just been discussing, it's permeated our culture or multiple cultures throughout all history. And so there's obviously a psychological predisposition towards this kind of, you know, mythos, I think. You know, we are all still, you know, as far as we've come with technology, with, you know, refinements to our society, we are still one step away from the wild. It's right outside our windows and doors at any given second. And, you know, any of us could run right into the woods and never come back and, you know, live out our days. So we are still one step removed from dumb beasts in many ways, I think.
In a lot of ways we are. But again, is that all there is to this, or could there be more to it? I mean,
I think there could be more to it. I just think that is a fear that we have. I think that's something that draws at us, and that's one of the reasons this kind of, like I said, mythos has permeated through all these different cultures.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. But again, you know, and the purpose of what I want to discuss this hour is in part to say if we're, you know, scholarly of mindset, and we say that, well, we can absolutely acknowledge the various different mythologies, whether or not we see them as actual histories that involve these kind of things, you know, at what point do we look at the modern corollary for that? In other words, the anecdotal data, the reports where people describe actually having seen these things, the few videos, and few though they are, that are good enough to actually interest us, if not compel us toward belief. And at some point, we finally have to kind of start saying, okay, look, do we have enough evidence on hand that even if not strongly supporting the existence of this creature, is enough to compel us to study it seriously, to make determinations? I am rather amazed that we often have this attitude that there's nothing to see here, and we have determined that, whereas we, again, have physicists and others in different divisions and areas of science who are more than happy to step outside that, you know, cool kid camp, step beyond that line that defines the fringe and say, you know, say, look, if we're to be scientific, again, our duty is to say there is an awful lot of data. There's an awful lot of evidence. There's an awful lot of information, a lot of stories, you know, some decent videos, a few good photographs, but mostly anecdotal reports from witnesses. And yes, cultural traditions, histories, and mythologies dating back to the beginning of civilization that all account for similar things. And I think that at very least what we need to do at the outset, there needs to be like a broad anthropological study. Let's examine beliefs. Let's look at traditions. Let's not presuppose that this is all crazy. Let's treat this also from the biological angle as though we're looking for an actual flesh and blood organism.
Yeah, exactly. And also, on the inverse side of things, don't pigeonhole yourself into being like, we're going out there and we're going to find Harry from Harry and the Hendersons. You know, maybe it's not what we've built it up to be as a Bigfoot creature. It could be more akin to a feral, you know, for lack of a better phrase, evolutionary offshoot of who we currently are or something.
Yeah, but at what point, you know, does that concept, like what you're saying, you know, again, I appreciate you kind of sanitizing the subject, because really this need that we require a little of that. Obviously, the modern mythos of Bigfoot has built so much onto this and made it so much larger than life that it is a hard pill to swallow for those who are, you know, academic-minded people and serious researchers who deal with real issues as it relates to biology. Maybe we need a little sanitization. Maybe we do need to try and redefine the expectations for the scientific community who might otherwise hopefully look for answers to this mystery. And maybe we need to try and demystify the mystery of Bigfoot, because if we can demystify it to an extent, we can bring some credible discussion to this subject, which is something that I think needs to be discussed credibly. And so again, for guys like David Politis, who in his Missing 411 books talks about strange cases where a child disappears animals, you know, dogs are following the scent. They go up over a mountain that the child alone shouldn't have been able to make it on their own, down the backside of the mountain, and then the dogs sit down by a boggy or marshy area where the trail appears to lead and the dogs won't go any further. You know, when we hear stories like that, is that evidence of the existence of a creature like Bigfoot? Absolutely not. It's a disappearance, but it is anomalous. There are definitely strange aspects of that disappearance that maybe can't be fully accounted for. But I can completely understand why David Paulides and other writers don't go down that Bigfoot bandwagon when discussing mysteries like that, because as much as we discuss demystifying the mystique of Sasquatch, sometimes we also have to treat those tangent mysteries, if they're even that, with the same level of sobriety. We have to try and deal with these things in terms of, here's what we know, here's what we have observed, here are patterns and correlations that arise, but we can't come to a conclusion if we don't have enough evidence to support whatever that is. And I do think sometimes that the mystery that we associate with these subjects, it's fun to be mysterious, it's fun to look at mysteries, but sometimes a little sanitation is required. And that mystery that we append to subjects like Sasquatch may take away from the furtherance of knowledge. It'll have to be the final thought for this week's edition of the Grailian Report. As always, a pleasure to be able to spend some time with you guys out there in space and time. And on behalf of all of us here at Grailian International Headquarters, Chris Hayes, Caleb Hanks, Tyler Pittman, Jeremy London, Rayson Robin Hobbs, Dick Oakley, John Anderson, Jason Pentrail, Tiffany Mack, and the lovely assistant Lauren, he is Matthew Oakley, I'm Micah Hanks, and we are Team Grailian. Glad to keep you guys company every week from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time via KGRARadio.com. And until next time, as always, my friends, stay strange out there. We'll catch you next week.
Listening to the Grailian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Grailian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website, GrailianReport.com.